Hello, good afternoon. This is Galen Joseph Hunter. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM in Acre, Catskill, and Hudson. And I am here live in our Hudson studio with our special guest for this Saturday afternoon, Laura Kuhn. Laura Kuhn is the director of John Cage Trust. She's a writer, performer, scholar, and arts administrator. In 1986, she began working with the American composer, poet, visual artist, and philosopher John Cage in New York on a variety of large-scale projects, including his six mesozoistic, I'm saying that wrong, Laura's going to correct me, lectures for Harvard University as holder of the Charles Eliot Norton Chair in Poetry. From 1991 and 96, she served as one of 10 founding faculty members at Arizona State University West in Phoenix, where she helped to develop and implement an innovative interdisciplinary arts and performance program. Upon Cage's death in 1992, she worked with Cage's longtime friends and associates to found the John Cage Trust, for which she continues to serve as executive director. In this capacity, Kuhn travels extensively lecturing and conducting performances, conducting performance workshops in venues as diverse as the Shanghai Conservatory of Music, Warsaw's Museum of Contemporary Art, and the Brussels International Arts Festival. In 2007, the John Cage Trust went into residential placement at Bard College in Annandale-on-Hudson, New York, where Kuhn became the first John Cage Professor of Performance Arts. She's currently working with the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer Ken Silverman on the John Cage Correspondence Collection for Wesleyan University Press, which I think is due out soon. Welcome, Laura. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Galen. It's nice to be here.
So tell our listening audience how you first came to meet John Cage and do the work that you've done with him and his history.
Well, it was actually, no pun intended, a bit of chance. I was in 1985 a graduate student at UCLA, and I won a grant. I applied for and received a grant to study intermedia art in New York, what we used to call intermedia art. I think that's an outdated term now, but really looking at art forms that were collaborative art forms between pairs of people working in different media, distinct media. So, for example, Cage Cunningham. For example, at the time, Meredith Monk and Ping Chong. I worked in a theater workshop with Robert Wilson and Heinrich Müller on a play that Wilson was adapting for the stage. I did a lot of research at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, but I tossed Cage Cunningham into that mix, but in point of fact, they weren't part of my original grant proposal. Oddly, it's actually very strange that they weren't, but they weren't. And it was a four-month grant, very lavish in its time and its money, its support. But I had a month left with nothing to do, and the person who was leading the granting program, who had herself moved to New York, named Pia Gilbert, a great friend of John Cage's, simply called me up one day and she said, "What are you going to do?" I won't mimic her beautiful Viennese accent, which she maintains and cultivates to this day, and I do very well. She called me up and she said, "What are you going to do for your remaining month?" And I said, "I really don't know. Do you have any suggestions?" And she said, "Would you be willing to help John Cage?" And I said, "Yeah." So literally, she had just gotten off the phone with John Cage, who was complaining to her that he was in the middle of working on an opera for Frankfurt, in which he was functioning in a kind of Wagnerian role, in that he was the director and the composer and the lighting person, and he was really doing everything, and he was completely behind schedule. And he was just beside himself, he needed help. And he had an assistant at the time, his name is Andrew Culver, who now lives in Canada. Andrew, however, was much more focused on Cage's computer needs and plus there was more work than even two of them could do. So anyway, that long story short is that I said, "Yes, of course, I would love it." And I was living at the time about 10 blocks from John and Merce's apartment on Waverly Place with, oddly enough, Nicholas Slonimsky's daughter. Slonimsky was a very revered, iconoclastic lexicographer, also in Cage's circle in a funny way. But I lived with Electra, that was her name. just very close to John Immers. And so when John called, which was within the hour, and said, "Can you come and help me?" in his little soft voice. He spoke not at all as one might expect if you'd never met him, a very quiet voice. And I said, yes, of course. And I went over there the next morning, and we spent 3 hours watering his plants. He had about 300 of them. Wow. And we literally watered plants for 3 hours and talked. In the course of talking, we got to know each other really pretty quickly. He was very forthright, very candid about himself, and I had no reason not to be. I was just a grad student, you know, and I was so taken with him. And we really just struck up an enormous friendship, but I would say even more than that friendship in the beginning was a great respect and understanding of how the other person worked. Because he, more than anything, I think, needed someone that he didn't have to tell what to do. And I, more than anything, being headstrong and the sort that I am, needed to do things the way I thought they should be done. So it was a really beautiful balance. And he immediately gave me some work to do on the opera. He basically, in the beginning, turned over to me the creation of the costumes for the composition, which was called the Europeras 1 and 2, Europe and operas joined together, big collage work. I knew nothing about costumes, nothing about costuming, but that really wasn't the way Cage worked anyway. It had to do with, you know, what he wanted it to look like on the stage, and could I come up with some idea about what that would look like on the stage that would be in keeping, and I did. So I basically worked with him from 86. I stayed in New York for a couple of years beyond that, and then I went back to Los Angeles to do a doctorate in systematic musicology at UCLA. But Cage and I were kind of joined at the hip after that, and so I came back to New York 4 or 5 times a year. I got to tour with him twice in the last year of his life, and when he died, I found myself in the happy/unhappy position of being the person who knew the most about a lot of different things.
Wow.
Yeah, it's yeah. That I just condensed 6 years for you.
So the trust was formed in 92 after his death. You did this in collaboration with people who were very close to Cage, right?
Yes, I did. The trust was not, there was no mandate left by Cage about anything. Cage responsibly had made a will, of course, and left everything to Merce Cunningham, his lifelong partner. Merce Cunningham was going into his, I guess it was his 40th year anniversary with his company. So he was grieving, and he was overwhelmed by work with his own creative needs and his own life. So really a lot of the work of the closure, if you will, of Cage's life was kind of fell on me and one other person. His name is Bennett Grutman, who was the executor of John Cage's estate. And so I was teaching at the time. I had taken a full-time teaching job in Arizona, and I was in my first year, my blossom year, really working my tail off in that program, and I was being called back to New York every other week to put out some fire or to help somebody. There were a lot of dissertations in progress, LPs at the time, so just barely CDs. I guess CDs were there, but people putting albums together, museum exhibitions that weren't quite done. And anyone who knew John Cage knows that he was the greatest source or resource, if you will, to people who were engaged with his work. So if you were writing an article, he would have you over to lunch, and he would let you scrounge around his apartment and look through his library, and, you know, so all of a sudden the world was left with nobody to let them do that. And so that was my job, was to really give them access. And so that went on for a year, and then after pretty much exactly a year, I just collapsed. I literally said, I can't do this anymore. It's, you know, and Merce Cunningham was horrified. he said, what do you mean? And I said, what do you need? He said, what do you need? And I said, well, I guess I need a bed. I had been sleeping in Cage's bed in Merce's loft. I said, I need a bed. I need a telephone. I need a fax machine. You know, I need blah, 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 whatever it was that I decided I needed. And he said, we'll do it. We'll do it. So it really, I like to say that the trust was formed to protect the sanity of the living. You know, it was really just to create a structure around us so that we could actually help people. And that was in 93. So it was about a year after he died.
And the trust has since blossomed into something much more, right?
It's very funny.
How would you describe the functionality or the mission of the trust now?
Yeah, let me begin the answer by saying that when we formed the trust, it was as a closure mechanism. It really was just to see catalogs done of the holdings. And by the way, the trust archives, which are now fill a house and more, we have storage now in two places. But the entire archives of the John Cage Trust were formed by Cage's holdings. Anything that was in the apartment was assumed by the John Cage Trust. So Cage's library, all of his manuscripts, anything that you can think of. We formed a visual art collection, a permanent collection from the visual artworks that were left, both in Merce's personal collection and with Cage's gallerist. So the trust was really formed to, we saw it as a 4 to 5 year endeavor, that we were going to do this, get all those things placed out in the world, but it just didn't happen. It grew. It actually had the opposite effect, I think, in part just because Cage continues to function in the world, you know, that it isn't a matter of putting him away, we're done, he's gone. And it's ironic in a way, because a lot of people voiced the opinion that a lot of what Cage kept Cage vital in the world was Cage's presence. Anyone who ever was with him, you know, just, it didn't matter on some level what they thought of his work, they loved being with him. You know, they loved his ideas and his humor and his nature. They just loved that. So when he died, people kind of thought, yeah, well, you know, but it hasn't been the case. And so the John Cage Trust, now we're entering our 20th year in 2013, our 20th year. And I can say that really I've seen shifts of interest every, I would say, 3 to 4 years. There's a different kind of focus, be it across media or be it across kinds of work within one medium. For example, we might go through a real strong period for percussion music, or a really strong period for visual art exhibitions. Or so it just varies. Right now we're kind of still at the tail end of what I call the techno interest. You know, the aspect of the younger generation that's come forward, and they're astonished at the things that Cage did with technology long before their parents were even thought of, kind of thing, you know. So we've just grown. And furthermore, people keep sending us things. We probably acquire, I don't know how many books and recordings or programs, manuscripts of one kind or another, letters, 10 items a week.
Wow.
Easily.
Wow.
From people all over the world saying, oh, my grandmother had this, or my brother is a musician and he found this, and you know.
Oh, that's
and
really
we
nice.
Still don't have everything. Yeah. I mean, that's the real irony here, is that you know, as try as we might, we will never acquire everything that's out there relating to John Cage.
So 2012 marks the centennial of Cage's birthday.
That's exactly right, September 5th.
And I'm curious about the incredible meaning around this centennial marker, and wondering if, when I had the good fortune to spend time with Nam June Paik, one of Cage's collaborators, before Paik died in 2006, I believe.
Has it been that long?
I'm pretty sure. I think it was February 2006, wow. I think. Paik always talked about starting this cable video art channel on television in 2012 in honor of Cage. And is it simply the magnitude of 100 years, or was there something from that Cage was also fixated on about this 100-year mark?
Cage, I don't remember really Cage being fixated on anything in particular, except maybe, you know, his ice cream maker when he discovered it, or macrobiotic food, or whatever was the enthusiasm of the day. But no, I mean, if you think about, you know, the fact that he didn't think about his legacy, I shouldn't say that way. I'm sure he thought about his legacy, don't we all? You know, but he didn't think about what would happen to his work after he died. He was always really interested in what he was doing. So leaving everything to Merce, you figure it out. You guys are still here, you do it. He never, you know, I don't think he thought in those terms in the slightest. But other people, Cage means a lot to people. He just means a lot to people. You know, I would say that that's probably what keeps Cage certainly what keeps Cage in the culture, but it also keeps the Cage Trust alive, because people want a space that they can come into. They want to know that Cage's works are somewhere. They, you know, but I don't think that Cage himself really thought about that. But Nam June was fixated on it.
Yeah.
I heard from his nephew, Ken Hakuda, that he, to his dying day, was talking about John Cage's 2012 having to do with food, something having to do with macrobiotic food. I think that's because John Cage, every time he saw Nam June, and Nam June got bigger and bigger and less healthy because of his diet, Cage would admonish him.
Oh, maybe, you know? Yeah. So there is this incredible attention being given to the 100-year birthday, right? And the trust is a very big part of helping to organize and catalog and contribute to all of these events. Is
yes.
that fair to say?
Yes. The Cage Trust is a very responsive organization. So that isn't to say that we don't produce new things spontaneously, if you will, but that we're really responsive to what the public needs. So we are guided a lot by what people are doing and what they want us to do or help them with. And one of the things that began to happen, I'd say really sort of in the beginning of 2010 or so a solid year ago, was that people started to come to me and say, you know, 2012 is a centenary, we want to do X, what do you think about that, you know? And so that was going on, but it reached a real escalation in the beginning of this year, in 2011, to the extent that I could no longer hold it in my head what people were doing. And I was getting a lot of requests from people asking me to, for example, an ensemble in LA would call and say, can you send me a list of all the ensembles that are contemplating doing things around John Cage in 2012. Who had this list, you know? So we put an aspect on our website, which is johncage.org, and within that, it's called 2012 Centennial, and within that, there's an aspect called events listings. So we're just really pushing people to the website to just post what they're doing, both to publicize, so people can see what's happening, you know? But also to avoid redundancies. You know, it's just really sad when you get six ensembles in New York City all doing a concert on the same day. You know, it's not good for business, if you will. And we're at the stage now, I would say, that music is a little easier because you can have multiples. You can have 50 pianists all over the world playing Cage's sonatas and interludes, and isn't that lovely? But you can't have an exhibition of his watercolors in 50 different places. So the reservation, if you will, of our collection and, frankly, the works of other people, that's pretty depleted now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all been asked for. It's all been, you know, we are responsible to a number of organizations around the world now that will be taking those works for particular reasons. So now it's a real challenge because we're trying to help people who want to do something, but they can't go to the easy answer, you know? So it's like, what are you going to do? What's your space like? What are your resources? What kind of people, you know, inhabit your space? You know? So we're having to be even more creative than we were before.
Do you have a number in your head of what you know about in terms of how many exhibitions, how many events?
Well, I can tell you that in terms of major exhibitions, you know, we have, I would say, three off the top of my head of major exhibitions, meaning an exhibition at the National Academy Museum in New York, which will do a major exhibition of Cage's watercolors. And that opens, by the way, in September of 2012, not really coinciding with Cage's birthday, which is always being over Labor Day weekend, people avoid because people go out of town. So that's actually a nice thing. So Philadelphia Museum is doing a big show also in September, having to do with, I won't give too many details about this because it's a work in progress, but involving the work of Jasper Johns, Rauschenberg, Merce Cunningham, John Cage around the subject or the work of Marcel Duchamp, so which is quite appropriate for the Philadelphia Museum since they're the largest holder of sure. Duchamp's works in America, at least. Lyon, and I'm actually curating my first show at the Contemporary Art Museum in Lyon. It's going to be a exhibition called Cage's Art of Embodiment. So looking at Cage's works that were made using the works of other people. So what he did with Thoreau, what he did with Duchamp, what he did with James Joyce. It's really astonishing, the embodiment of those people in this single man, the single American artist. And then, I mean, off the top of my head, you know, just in New York, for example, Juilliard Focus Festival this year in 2012, January is devoted to John Cage. The New School is making noises about doing its thing. Symphony Space is hosting something in May and September. They're working out their details. I mean, it just goes on like that. So Carnegie Hall is doing two or three things. Michael Tilson Thomas with the San Francisco Symphony is doing songbooks, Cage's songbooks, with Jesse Norman, of all people.
It
just goes on and on and on. You know, these are just really just off the top of my head. And there's countless one-offs, you know, countless special evenings by particular ensembles, special performances of little-known works, people rooting around to find what they can contribute to a really big picture.
Sure.
You know.
And have you been asking people who come to you for help and for information to provide some kind of documentation?
Always. Always, yeah. So anyone who comes to me for any reason about anything, I say, please, you know, if you do this, send us your programs. Mm-hmm. Please go to the website. Please list it, you know, so that we can try to keep track of all the things that are happening. In part just because one likes to show up, you know, if it's at all possible. Cage, that was a really big thing about John Cage. And I can't tell you how many really now aging artists in New York remember John Cage as attending, whenever he was in town, going to everything. If you invited him, he would come. And there's a beautiful, I think it was Trisha Brown, talking about they wouldn't start the concert because they were looking out the window and it was a snowy night and everybody was late anyway, but they were waiting for John Cage to walk down the street. And he did. And they held the door, you know. So it's enormously important for people to, when they do something, for someone to show up, you know, someone that says, yeah, this is important to me. I'm going to travel the state over, two states over, to see what you're doing, or fly across the ocean, for that matter. So I try to do that whenever I can.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. It is really amazing. I mean, the really amazing thing is that it just keeps me engaged, you know, really for almost 20 years now.
Yeah.
I have the same enthusiasm for his work and his ideas than I had the day I met him. And I think in part because it's not over for me yet. I once asked Merce Cunningham a question. I had some, I don't even remember what it was. I had what I thought to be some brilliant idea about something. And come to be that Cage had had the very same idea in 1939 and did it in a way that I would have never conceived of doing it. And I was sitting, Merce Cunningham and I were having dinner together one night, and I was sort of glum about this. And I said, do you think there'll ever be a time when John Cage is you know, that isn't one step ahead of us? And Merce looked at me really quiet for a second. He said, do you mean when he's assimilated? And I said, maybe. And he just smiled and he said, not in your lifetime. And I think he's right. You know, I think he's just, when people say, what was John Cage doing? My response often to them is, what is John Cage doing? Because the work is not historic. It isn't really historic work. It's idea generating. It's creativity inducing. You know, anything, any work you pick up of John Cage's makes you want to make something else.
Well, Pike again used to kind of jokingly tell me that everything that Free 103.9, WGXC's parent organization, was doing with radio as a creative medium was absolutely derivative, if not repetitive, of Cage, which maybe brings us to talking a little bit about Cage and radio.
Yeah.
So you've got some plans.
We do. Right. Well, in that 2012 picture, which is maybe a way to think about it, in that 2012 picture, the John Cage Trust, which has fairly limited resources, we, you know, just FYI, we earn our keep, so we're not a fundraising, grant, you know, seeking organization. We really just earn, we spend what we can earn. And so our resources are fairly limited, so that when we produce things, we look for partnerships, we look for ways of doing grand things that don't require huge amounts of money. And it is possible that it takes a lot of time. So, but people believe that we are producing, you know, everything. We're producing very little. We're producing actually, we're doing three or four things in celebration of the centennial. the first, well, let me just talk specifically to radio because that's the focus of your question and we don't have all day.
I wish we did.
Well, I'll come back. But relative to radio, so one of the things that I thought would be a really beautiful thing, I too, like other people, said, what could we produce that would bring something that's little known to light? You know, it doesn't have to be groundbreaking, just something that doesn't get a lot of airtime, that doesn't get, no pun intended, you know, it doesn't get a lot of exposure. And I was thinking about works also at the same time that I really love that don't do that. One of them, of course, is your operas, which no opera house wants to touch because it's frightfully expensive and antagonistic on so many levels to opera. So opera, it's like, you know, the anti-opera from their point of view. I don't feel that way, but it's how it's viewed. But one of the works is this particular piece that I think we're going to play a little bit of today, a work called The City Wears a Slouch Hat, which is a work by John Cage, a collaborative work with Kenneth Patchen, the American poet, based on a libretto by Patchen and a work for radio. And it was one of the works that I've always been fascinated by. I saw it in a very, very, very student production, a little theatricalization in the Fringe Festival, with Merce Cunningham, in fact, and we were both enchanted. I think their production budget was $27.18. It was fantastic. I mean, you could really feel where the work came from. Mm-hmm. But I remember coming out and we talked about it for a long time that night, and it struck me as a cross between Our Town and David Lynch. If you can imagine those two things, this kind of real Americana and this sort of sideways treatment of it, mm-hmm. or something. So I've always loved the work and I've always been really keen on somebody doing something with this work. And I thought, maybe this is the opportunity. This is how I really am coming to an answer to your question.
I'm confident.
Okay. So that work, I knew I wanted to do something with this work. And I went to the composer, Michael Rouse, who I adore, both personally, but as a composer, I think he's really one of the finest composers of my generation. And I said, what would you do with this work if you were to do something with this work? And I gave him everything. I gave him manuscript to look at and recording, of which there are only two, the historic, which we're going to hear, and then a remake by Mode Records that came out within the last decade, which is lovely, but it's not the historic recording. Anyway, I gave all these things to Michael Rouse, and I said, what do you think about this? And he came back to me, and he said, I'd like to make a film. And I said, a film? You mean a film about City Wears a Slouch Hat? And he said, no, a film that goes with it. And I said, well, what was that? I'm still, you know, totally nonplussed and confused. It's like, well, what would that look like? And he said, I don't know, but it, like a film with just light and shadows as a kind of backdrop maybe to performance or something. And when you hear a little bit about the work, I think the listening audience and will begin to see what he was talking about because it's very noir. It's about an unnamed character, he's called The Voice, who moves around in the dark in Metropolis, you know, in at dawn and experiences strange characters and sees strange things and finds himself in odd circumstances that he can't explain. And so it's very noirish. So that led to a conversation with him about creating a kind of modular setting. The composition performed live. You could have the composition performed in recorded form. It's scored for actors, so you could have it acted out. You could literally dramatize it, as they did in the Fringe Festival. Mm-hmm. You could have them read it, a la, you know, Schaefer at Symphony Space, you know, those beautiful poetry nights or those literary nights that they do. You could just show the film, you know, have the film be the thing that you're looking at. So it just struck me as a beautiful kind of thing to do, to put our attention to. It's 30 minutes long, so it isn't a program. It isn't, what is it? You know, it doesn't pair well with other children. You know, it's a very singular, strange little piece. So I begin to think about the piece, like, what else is unique about this piece? And it struck me that, well, what's unique is that it's a radio broadcast. It was conceived for radio broadcast. It was conceived for radio broadcast very, very early on, 1942. So mind you, Cage was barely 30. If even 30. He was 29. He was 29 years old. He was an aspiring young composer. He had, you know, left the Cornish School in Seattle and he was going toward New York because that was what one did. He ended up on an invitation by Moholy-Nagy to teach a course at Moholy Nagy's School of Design in Chicago, hated Chicago. He was there, I think, for all of 1 year. But while he was there, got a commission from the Columbia Broadcast System for their radio workshop to make this piece. And then I'm going to tell you how he made this piece, and then I'll stop and you can ask a question because I'm talking forever. And we would like to listen to some things. But what's interesting about this piece is that Cage believed one of his big, big push in life, he finally abandoned it, but it took a long, long time, like into the 60s, well into the 60s, was to establish a center for experimental music that would bring together percussion, the resources and the freshness of percussion with the resources of technology, whatever that looked like. And nobody cared. Nobody was going to do this. Nobody was going to put money into it. And when he got to Chicago, this amazing thing happened, that a radio station came to him and commissioned him to write this composition. And he went to the radio, literally to the station, and he said, can you show me what kind of sound effects you can do? And can you show me? And they said, we don't have time for you. Just go write it, and we can do anything you want. So Cage he thought he had died and gone to heaven. And he went home, and he worked diligently, and he created a score, all of which, 150 pages, that was to be realized in the radio station. So 1 week before the broadcast, he went in with his score, and they looked at him and said, are you nuts? They said, we can't possibly do this. And at that point, they showed him what their resources were, which were extremely limited, cowbells, you know, clavis, you know, these very simple noisemakers that simulated things. And Cage realized how foolish he'd been, and, you know, that. Anyway, he went home and he rewrote the entire piece for a percussion ensemble who themselves made sound effects and for readers. And so that's what the work is. But it was conceived for radio broadcast. And that. So one of the unique things about the piece, is that it was conceived for radio. And I began to think about Cage and technology, Cage and radio. And I began to realize that there are a tremendous number of works that Cage wrote either for broadcast, or there are works in his catalog that were to be conceived as radio broadcasts, you know, so that they were to be realized in a radio station. Right. There are works in which radios are instruments. There are works, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he wrote text works for radio. He wrote radio plays, very sort of traditional, if you will, in terms of the delivery of them. So his engagement with radio goes way, way back. And I began to think that nobody had ever really celebrated that about him. You know, what was he doing with radio, and what was the fascination? Do you know that he produced a show for the Boy Scouts of America on radio?
I did not know that.
He did.
What was
and
that like?
I've never heard it. I've never been able to find it, because it turns out that it wasn't approved. It wasn't approved by the Boy Scouts of America, and they shut him down. Mm. But it apparently went on for 2 or 3 programs in Los Angeles. He was so keen on doing this, and then they shut him down, and the real Boy Scouts came in and took it over, and the program failed and it went away. But so there's a really, really long engagement with radio.
Do you have first person recollections of radio in Cage's life, or conversations about radio that convey this really particular and intense interest?
No, you know, it's funny. I actually was thinking about this the other day, because the only thing I really do remember is him talking about how he didn't like radio. He didn't like the ubiquity of radios. He didn't like the sound of radios in the subway. He didn't. And there's a beautiful exchange. I don't know if you ever read that or heard the radio happenings between Cage and Morty Feldman.
No, I haven't.
I have them. If you want to come spend some time at the Trust, they're really beautiful, and maybe we can get you licensed to air them.
Yeah.
But they're also published in a transcript by a German publication. But anyway, in this conversation, it's just a little tiny point, is that Morty Feldman was complaining about radios on the beach. He was complaining about environmental noise. And John Cage says something. I have to go back and find this quotation exactly, but he says something like, you know how I solved that problem for myself, don't you? And Morty said, no, how? And John Cage, well, I made a composition for radio, so now whenever I hear a radio, I think they're playing my piece. And he starts laughing. But there's some truth to that, you know, that Cage was one. Cage used to say that if you didn't like something, don't criticize it, but rather do something better. Find out what it is that you don't like and do something in response to it. Like, what would you make if, you know?
Right.
And so...
So it's responsive, not reactionary.
Exactly. Really. Yeah. And it isn't critical, but rather constructive.
Yeah.
You know, it was make something new. So when he didn't like something, he really had to look at why he didn't like it, you know.
So that's good advice.
I know. Do you want to play a little bit of this one?
Yeah, let's. Okay.
This is, let me say a little bit about,
please.
Well, play a little bit and then I'll say a little bit about the recording.
Okay. And we should just start from the beginning?
I suppose. Why not?
Okay.
Today, the workshop presents The City Wears a Slouch Hat by Kenneth Patchen. The score is for Sound Orchestra by John Cage. The City Wears a Slouch Hat.
It's beginning to rain a little. We'll just move back here into this doorway. There. That's better.
But honest, kid, I didn't mean to say it.
You and your apologies, boy. How come every time we get the mothers, you have to start again?
Yeah, that's the way it is.
Say, buddy, you got something to spare a fella? I ain't eaten since yesterday.
Sure. Here.
Thanks. I hate to bother, but I...
Say, let's have a look.
It's just a pile of old rags in the alley.
Can't be too careful around these old buildings.
Yeah. Say, that rain's really beginning to come down. I'm going to duck back under this awning.
And a dozen oranges.
Mm-hmm. These are the navel.
I want them for juice.
Oh, a dozen, you say?
Yes, and I want a bunch of celery. 3 pounds of your best tomatoes.
We better find another spot. This looks well out of the weather.
Stick them up, Jack.
They're up.
Fork over.
Here we are. My wallet. My wristwatch.
Now, don't try anything fancy. I'd as soon plug you as breathe.
I bet you would. Here. I think that's all.
You're a smart fella. Well, he's seen you.
Just a minute. You won't have any use for the cards and the photograph in my wallet. Return them to me, please.
Okay. I've got no use for them. Here you are.
Thank you very much. Good night.
So long.
Hey, whose picture you got there? Your wife? Maybe your mother, huh?
No.
Okay, bud. Keep your little secret.
It's no secret. It's your picture.
What? Say, what are you handing me?
Here, look for yourself.
Geez. Hey, look, I here, take your money. I don't want to get mixed up in nothing like that.
Like what? Don't be a fool. I can't stand all night here in the rain talking to you. Good night.
But I don't want...
I can't help what you want. That wind's beginning to go right through me. What I need is a little good cheer.
Yes, sir?
Nice crowd tonight.
Pretty good.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening. Wait, I'll take my cigarettes out of the coat first.
Here's your check, sir.
Thank you.
Evening, table.
No, I'll just stand here.
What did you have?
Oh, let's see. Give me a bit of that.
This is?
That's right. Go easy on the lemon.
Listen, Al, that nanny goat couldn't win a race if they put snowshoes on the other team.
Have it your way.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce a little lady.
I don't care much for her voice. I don't want a paper.
Here, give me one. Here you are. Now, Ed, you know as well as I do that a thing like that can cause a lot of trouble.
Yeah, but I still think you could make something out of it. Why, there was...
That sounds like it might be interesting. We'll see.
A dog, maybe, but not a horse.
What's the matter with a horse?
There ain't nothing the matter with a horse. But if it was a dog, I'd feel a lot better.
Okay, you'd feel better. But that horse ain't a dog. Ed, go ahead. Bite your own first. What's Ida think? What's Ida
think? Okay, so this is Galen Joseph Hunter. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, and I'm sitting here in the Hudson studio with the director of the John Cage Trust, Laura Kuhn. And Laura, can you tell us what we were just listening to a little bit?
Yes, we were listening to the historic recording of a composition by John Cage created for the Columbia Workshop radio broadcast system in Chicago in 1942 called The City Wears a Slouch Hat. That work, by the way, I just wanted to say that Cage was conducting that live in the studio, and one of the percussionists was his then-wife, Cage. This is pre-Cunningham days. Her name was Xenia Cage. She was a bookbinder. And that was Les Tremaine is playing the, for those of you who are radio buffs and maybe know those old-time actors, those readers for radio, but Les Tremaine was playing the part of the voice. The instruments included tin cans, muted gongs, wood blocks, alarm clocks, tam-tams, bass drum, Chinese tom-tom, bongos, cowbells, maracas, clavis, ratchet, pod rattle, foghorn, thunder sheet, and sound effect recording.
Nice.
Mm.
So you were saying before we listened that this is a piece that you're going to be producing as part of the centennial.
Exactly. In a concert, in a program that's going to premiere at Bard College. We haven't set dates yet, but I think we're settling into October of 2012. A program called John Cage On and Off the Air, involving works by Cage that were either conceived for radio or that use radios or that are conceived within radio stations.
You know, as I'm listening to this and hearing about the live conducting and all of the instrumentation, I'm reminded about how little we've really played with this radio station WGXC and how magnificent it will be to have something related to this kind of radio work happening in the future.
Will this happen through perhaps the open call?
Exactly.
Mm.
So part of why Laura and I are here today is to also, I think, formally announce and talk a bit about this collaboration between Free 103.9 and WGXC and the John Cage Trust, which is an open call, an international open call for works that are in response to Cage's radio work. And we've kind of divided the possibilities into three categories, right? Recordings of performance or re-performance or presentation of Cage radio composition, live performances that either take place remotely or on site here at one of WGXC's studios, or something that's in response to or homage or inspired by these Cage works that used radio or responded to radio or were about radio. And we're inviting people to submit their works. There's information up on the WGXC website, which is wgxc.org. And the deadline for submission is March 1st, 2012. So there's lots of time, perhaps, depending on how complicated people's ideas are. And then the idea being that in September, the Labor Day weekend of September 2012, in honor of the centennial of the 100th birthday, these works will, some will be performed in person and live and presented as part of a Transmission Arts Symposium we're producing, a convening. And then the entire month of September will really be in celebration of Cage's 100th birthday, and we're going to be airing a program called 120 Hours for John Cage. So Saturdays during the month of September of 2012 will be very much devoted to these works submitted through the open call.
It's so exciting.
It is. So, yeah, and even, you know, we sort of let slip a little bit the open call in our recent email announcement talking about you and I being on air, and people are excited. I'm expecting some really good things.
Yeah,
I'm hoping for some really good things. Is there, would it be interesting or useful to talk about a couple other works that or compositions of Cage's that you imagine
sure.
people might bring
sure.
to the table?
Well, we've already, so this work is simply a work that Cage created, initially created, conceived of it to be created in a radio station for broadcast via radio station. It turned out not to be the case. It turned out to be a work created for radio broadcast that minimally used the resources of a radio station. And the score is lost. So I just want to make sure that 5,000 people don't write to me tomorrow saying, can I see the original score? If it ever surfaces, I promise you, there's a blog that'll come out. But let's look at a couple of works that are actually that predate this. There are two very iconic works. Actually, anybody who knows anything about John Cage's music know the other two works fairly well, but they bear repeating. And one, let's listen maybe next to a work called Credo in Us. And Credo in Us is a a work actually that dates from the same year as The City Wears a Slouch Hat. It was premiered in Bennington, Vermont, with choreography by Merce Cunningham and Jean Erdman, who was at the time married to Joseph Campbell, I don't know how you say it, mythologist? So I don't know what the word for that is, but this is a work, an early work by John Cage that follows the phraseology of the dance. People that know much about John Cage know that not too long after the composition of this work, Cage and Cunningham began their signature practice of creating works that are independent of each other and are simply put together in performance. But this is one of those works that they're still working in the old-fashioned way, which is Merce giving John the counts and John creating music that fits with Merce's footsteps, if you will. What else can I tell you about it? It uses four performers. There's a pianist and then two percussionists who play muted gongs, tin cans, electric buzzer, and tom-toms, and one performer who plays a radio and a phonograph record. So this is one of the first works that actually uses, by John Cage, among the first works, so I won't say one of the first, but among the first works in which Cage uses a radio as an instrument.
Shall we have a listen?
Yes, please.
And the piece that we're going to excerpt from is 17 minutes and 17 seconds, but we'll listen for just a few minutes.
Yeah, right? Let's just take a little bit of
okay.
it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Oh, that's marvelous. I was hoping we would get that far. I realize we're running out of time, but the Jean Erdman has written about this piece historically, you know, her memories several years ago. And what she said was that at the original performance of it, which this is a historic recording, they created a tack piano instead of a prepared piano. So they actually put a tack piano was a kind of precursor of a prepared piano, and that they put tacks into the felt of the piano keys, and they would hit the strings and it would make that sound. So it's interesting. I didn't realize that this was also in this recording. I want to say one thing about so obviously that was a phonograph, that was not a radio. The original score for this piece actually designates, Cage wrote for radio, for performer on radio or phonograph. And then in the score designates phonograph first, and then midway through the piece radio, and then toward the end phonograph again. So clearly he meant phonograph and radio. But the subsequent score, that was how it was published in the original C.F. Peters score. The subsequent score simply says radio or phonograph and doesn't make that distinction in each point. So there's a little bit of confusion. Uh-huh. And even Cage acknowledged this. And I remember in an interview in 88 or 89 with Michael Williams talking about this and saying he just didn't know why that every time he heard this piece it was so different. And Michael Williams, who knew the piece better than Cage, had researched it upside down, said, well, it's because in the original manuscript you said this. So it depends on which score people have. Mm. You know. So it's just very funny. And I don't know what the recording is here. My musicology days are long behind me. But Cage's, in the score, it suggests for phonograph records to use Dvorak or Beethoven or Sibelius, or his personal favorite, which was his personal favorite was Dvorak, but Shostakovich would be okay too.
All right, so let's see, we're getting close to the top of the hour. Should we squeeze in one more?
I'm going to play a tiny bit of Imaginary Landscape.
Sure.
Imaginary Landscape is also an iconic work. This one dates from 1939, so prior to Cage's leaving Seattle. He was working with a radio station, again, and he was working. This is a particular piece that uses two variable speed phono turntables with frequency recordings. The label is Victor, for also muted piano and cymbal. And this work was to be performed as a recording or as a broadcast by four performers. This was performed in 1939 at the Cornish School by John Cage and his wife, Xenia, Doris Dennison and Maggie Jensen.
All right, we'll have a listen. It's so amazing that's 1939.
Isn't it? Yeah. It's incredible. That is, by the way, one of the first so-called electroacoustic works ever composed. One of the first. There were others. Respighi's Pini di Roma comes to mind. That's 24, so that was even earlier. But it's really just remarkable that people were making such work. If you created that today, we wouldn't blink.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. And he was 27.
27 years old.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
So those were just three examples of Cage's many compositions with, for, and about radio and broadcast. And I do encourage listeners who are interested in knowing more about this Open Call project to go to the WGXC website, which is wgxc.org, and you'll see the event listed 120 hours for John Cage, an open call for works celebrating Cage's radio compositions. You can also email opencall@FREE103POINT9.org, or you can just give this station here a call too. Laura, thank you so very, very much. And I can't believe how quickly this hour flew by.
You're welcome, Gillian. It was a pleasure.
And I know we'll have you back between now and the deadline for the open call, which is March 1st.
I look forward.
And maybe since we're at the top of the hour, Laura, you can take us out with a station ID if you'd be
I'd be
so
happy
generous.
To. This is Laura Kuhn of the John Cage Trust. You are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM ACRA, creative and community radio in Greene and Columbia counties.